Hello everyone, welcome back to the show, and today's guest is Mary Joyce. Mary Joyce, thank you very much for taking the time to be on the show.
Well, I'm looking forward to it, really.
So am I. You cover a lot now. How would you describe yourself? You were a writer for a magazine, a journalist, is that right?
I was an editor for two large city newspapers, and also did, you know, all sorts of writing for magazines and things of that nature. And I just have a big journalist curiosity that gets me into a lot of this.
Well, you cover a lot of areas, like we were saying just before the show. Now, we're sort of winging it here because you cover so many different areas. So maybe what would you like to start with? Because you do go into underground bases, you go into the UFO topic, you go into the Cherokee as well, and you go into Jesus. And not just that, this is just a small snippet of just some of the books that you've written on the topics. But where would you like to go to start to introduce people to yourself and who you are?
Why don't we start with the website? Mm-hmm. It's called skyshipsovercashers.com, and we deal with a lot of topics, and we have people that follow the website from other countries, so it's not just Americans. But there's a whole section that's devoted to global things, and it's called Global Links. It's on the left-hand side of the homepage. And we deal with major sightings from around the world, UFO sightings. We have some wonderful photos that were actually enhanced by a man from the Netherlands. And he was taking NASA photos from satellites that are always aimed at the sun. And then he would dust and clean them so you could see the details better. And these are humongous ships that sometimes appear around the sun. Bigger than Jupiter, much bigger than Jupiter. And when he cleans up the debris that obstructs the view, you can see incredible structures. And it's not like a little ball of or a globe. Some of them look like almost like big sailing ships, because you can see different tiers and different levels. And we first began to post those in 2013. So in every section of the website, there are archives up in the right-hand corner. And starting in 2013 is when we began to post those. So if people are really interested, go into the archives for 2013 and 2014. We may have something at the beginning of this year, but I honestly can't remember at this point.
There'll be a link beneath this video as well, so people can get linked straight to where you're talking about, to that website. And there is a lot of stuff there, isn't there?
There really, really is. And what I do it at two levels. I think we live in a very visual world. And so every story that we post has some kind of photo, some kind of artwork, something that, you know, enhances the word. So it's not just dull, gray copy. And I also use the newspaper style, where I try to write very condensed and easy to read and to the point, because people are just so busy. So what happens is, if you go to that section, you would click on a story. You would see a couple photos from a video, so you don't have to go any farther unless you want. And then you can click on a link and you can get, you know, greater details on many of these things.
So it's a quick hit for news and what's going on, which is good, because I checked it out myself, and that's what I liked. There was pictures, there was links, and it was sort of, you know, wham, bam, quick, to the point, because today, just like the kids, they need information quick, because everything's going so quick these days. So it's very worthwhile checking out that website, definitely.
And we also have gotten some of the satellite photos of Mars. And what I found fascinating is one of the YouTube videos showed one of those pictures, and it looked like a hangar entrance, like a contemporary modern entrance into Mars, like a major, major ship could, you know, fly right in there. But the coordinates were not very visible. So I spent time over a week's time scanning Mars, looking for some of the little visual clues, and I finally found it. And once I found it and I could put the coordinates on there for people, then I posted it on the website. Because there's a lot of hoaxers on the internet, and I'd like as much as possible to try to find it on my own, to try to confirm it in some way or another, so we're not just chasing, you know, people's fantasies.
Well, that's what we call good investigation journalism, which we don't have too much of these days.
The journalists have all had to flee the newspapers and go to the internet. Mm-hmm. I can remember when newspapers were big and thick and full of, you know, lots of good information. Simply not that way anymore.
No, and this is good, like you brought up the hoaxer scenario, because there is a lot of crap out there, and we're trying to get some, we're trying to understand what's going on. And, you know, we're all having experiences or something going on, but with so much, you know, fodder and hoaxing and crap in the field, it's hard. So this is where doing in-depth investigation and, you know, looking at resources and links and you know, investigating, it does come in handy and it gets to some more truth, you know, some more validity.
We started the website in 2008 simply because there'd been a whole lot of UFO sightings, and there continue to be a whole lot of UFO sightings in this area, which I live in the mountains of Western North Carolina, so there's mountains everywhere. And we kind of proved ourselves in the first year or two, and because of that, we began to have whistleblowers who wanted to get information out that they thought the public really needed to know. And since we proved our credibility, they were willing to come to us and present this information. And because of that, that's why I was able to write this most recent book, which is called, it's got a long title. It's called Underground Military Bases Hidden in North Carolina Mountains. And that's all based on whistleblowers who've come forward to let us know what's really happening.
Yeah,
and that thinking may seem like something far away from where you are, mm-hmm. but in the process of doing this and wondering why we have so much of this going on, I found out that our country signed a treaty in 1972, and it's the World Heritage Treaty. And we relinquished our rights to a number of our national parks and national forests, so they're no longer in control. They're no longer controlled by our country. They're controlled by the United Nations. And because of that, we're seeing foreign troops, the Blue Hats that are called the UN troops, operating in our forest. And for a long time, when I kept hearing these stories from hunters and hikers and you know, people just back in the woods who would run into foreign soldiers on maneuvers, and they said they would be speaking Russian or they would be German or they would be the Blue Hats. And the question always was why. And then I found out about this treaty, and we've turned over some of our parks around here to the UN, and we no longer control them. And the same thing is probably happening in your country.
That's what I was about to say, yeah. So we've got the same thing going on here, and I find that very weird that, you know, now you can understand why, but, you know, America's very patriotic. I'm sure if I was out bush and I found, you know, sort of a military exercise going on with people that didn't speak Australian, I'd be sort of a bit dodgy about what's going on. We've got an alliance, of course, with America, Canada, New Zealand, the UK, and a number of other countries, but it's a bit weird, especially when we're talking about national parks. So is there anything else you found out, or is this sort of a work in progress, sort of information still coming across your table in terms of working out a little bit more of what's going on here?
Whenever you do a book, you always have some other people come along with more information. So it's kind of a, there'll be more information, you know, that will come along. But the parks that I have featured, all these underground bases are under national parks or state parks. One is under the Smoky Mountains National Park. One is under Mount Mitchell, which is the tallest mountain east of the Mississippi. One is under is along the Blue Ridge Parkway. One is near Chimney Rock State Park. You know, they're just always hidden, and they're well hidden. So I don't know how far you want me to dive into that subject.
Well, I'd like to go into it a fair bit if we can, because look, there's a lot of things that go on at a lot of bases, whether, you know, there's evidence for it or not. There seems to be a lot of correlating evidence with holographic technology, space, you know, basically secret space programs, other things of spying. And when we look at these types of things, you know, in America, the Archuleta Mesa, Dulce Base, I've talked to some people that are, you know, to me, I think they're credible. Now, we can't prove this, but what I find interesting about what you're saying is that you've sort of found some correlating stuff to go. It's not just a hearsay story. And also on top of that, we know about Area 51. We know about Cheyenne Mountain and those sort of things. You know, a lot of what's going on in America, but like anything good, you know, over years, you know, eventually they came out about Area 51 and said, yes, it's an actual base. But when something's found out, there's always something else in the pipeline and it's hidden. And this is how things work. So what have you found in terms of correlating or evidence that validates the bases that you're looking into in terms of, you know, is there stuff like electrical grid systems found? Is there sort of tracks found? Is there openings found? Is there anything, and insiders, what can you go in with this sort of thing?
Okay, there's so much in my head. I got to sort it out and figure out where to start. Let's start with Mount Mitchell. The information came from a man that we call Hawk because we're protecting his identity. And he was in the medical field. And after he retired, he still had lots of energy. And he'd also been a medic in the Vietnamese War. When they found out his background, when he went to volunteer as a medic with the National Guard, they decided they wanted to put him to use in another way. And with his high security clearance with both the Army and the FBI, they put him on surveillance missions. And in the fall of 2014, he had a number of very, very interesting surveillance projects. One was he took a squad of men to Mount Mitchell, and they incognito were going through the forest around that mountain, and they saw UN blue hats come out of the backside of this mountain, and they came out in teams of two. There would be one man with one of those real heavy packs, backpacks, very heavily loaded, and then there would be another man with him. So there were four of these two-man teams. One team would go down the north side, one would go down the west side, you know, each side of the mountain, and they would take the old animal paths and things like that through the forest. They would dig holes about a foot deep, and they would take a sensor out of the backpack and put it into the hole and then cover it over. And the Hawk said they were very highly sensitive sensors, so they could tell if anybody was approaching the mountain, and they could distinguish animals from people. They figured that they put at least 100 sensors in the ground, each team, and they would weave around the side of the mountain. Those teams of blue hats came out of a back entrance on the mountain. Now, while they were doing their surveillance work, there were other surveillance teams working also. And one of them was in a nearby town called Marion, and there's a train station there. And during the night, the dark of night, they saw 20 to 25 tanks, military tanks, being taken off the train and putting on big tractor trailers. And these went up the mountain to Mount Mitchell and never came back down again. This man, Hawk, said that the entrance into this mountain is so well hidden, it looks like the side of the mountain. I don't know how he knows this, but his intelligence sources that train him said that the facility is 20 stories deep. And from what I understand, they try to make all of these underground facilities self-sufficient. Another underground base is called, we call it the Perry Center. I won't get into it because it won't mean a whole lot to you. But it used to be a World War or a Cold War monitoring station. And after the Cold War, they supposedly closed it down and just kept the surface instruments and buildings and satellites and supposedly used it as an educational astronomical center. Well, we had a really, really high security man finally come to us, and he gave us a written statement, and he said it was a city-sized facility that was six stories deep, had all of its own electricity and water, you know, and it's quite large. And it gets really complicated because one witness came forward. He said when he was a young man, he was working on a Christmas tree farm not far from this facility, and that people who worked there had seen animals in cages being taken into this facility. That ties in with reports of experiments going on in the base. One witness said that they did many different kinds of experiments, and they had the ability to totally wipe out human memory if they needed. Now, at this point, I can throw in a little bit of my own experience. When I've approached that place, there's this sensation that you get. It's not electrical, but it's like it interferes with your mind, and it makes you very uncomfortable. And when you get away from it, that disappears. There's been reports at other places, too, where people have had very distressing physical symptoms when they get too close to something that where they're not supposed to be. And to make it even more complicated, we see lots of UFOs in that same area. It's believed that some aspect of the ET world and some aspect of our Black Project world are working in tandem.
So have you heard that from some of the whistleblowers about this? And are they able to tell you anything else in terms of what the purpose are of these bases?
The man Hawk that I mentioned, he said that there are many within our military who are very concerned about these bases that are beyond the normal military control. And supposedly there is an increasing number of military people who are trying to be prepared to defend the country, so to speak, if it really gets out of control. Whether or not they can do that, whether or not that's going to happen, you know, we don't know. But that was the reasons for the surveillance.
Yeah, all right. All right. So what's been some of the top of UFO activity reported around the bases?
The whole area here in the mountains, we hear UFO reports, and none of them are the same. Oh, well, I shouldn't say that. But we have triangular ones, which may very well be man-made. Mm-hmm. We have round ones. We have big ones. We have ones that do rainbow colors. The most recent phenomena is quite interesting. They're UFOs that are seem to be fairly close to the Earth, and they look like asteroids. They look like big old rocks. They're not lit up, but we've gotten pictures of them. And on the Skyships Over Cashers website, under Skyship Photos, you can scroll through there and see those. They're totally different than anything else we've seen before. We've also had multiple reports of UFOs flying in and out of a lake that's just west of the Perry Center. Again, making it sound like there might be a connection between the two. One of the people who first told me about the UFO connection at Perry, he quit talking about it because he said every time he did, his computers got wiped out. So he ceased to be a source of information simply because it was too expensive.
Have you had anything investigating this where you've had stuff taken or been followed or monitored, you feel, in any way?
Only at the very, very beginning when I had a different computer, and it was a basic, simple computer, and just for caution's sake, in case there was an electrical storm or something, I would unplug it at night. And one night I unplugged it. The next morning I wanted to make a copy of a letter I'd written the night before. When I turned it on, all 10 of my folders that were devoted to UFO subjects were gone. Couldn't find them anywhere. And I had the man in charge of fixing all the computers for the university, which is nearby, and had him come and look at it. And so he got into the bowels of the computer and couldn't find any trace of those files. He said he'd never seen, and he spent time really, really trying to figure it out. He'd never seen just one type of file disappear and everything else remain intact. Now, that's my only experience as far as, you have to wonder.
Yeah, no, definitely, definitely. Getting back to the underground bases, was there any reports of underground maglev trains connecting these, or was it just, did you get anything sort of like that connecting to other bases?
Right. I wouldn't be surprised if all of the five places that I mentioned in the book or talk about in the book are connected by what I call like an underground subway system. And I'm sure you've seen these photos of these huge underground boring machines. Have you ever seen them?
Yeah, they're nuclear-powered tips on them, I think, and they just go through the rock and push it all out.
Right, they're cylinder-shaped. They would be bigger than a train, and they just go just zero on through the mountains. Depending on the type of soil, they can cut through like 7 miles in a day. Now, this is, again, indirect support for this type of thing. We've had people for a time who will experience grinding, vibrating sounds beneath their homes. It only lasts for a period of time, and then it stops. And that would probably be the result of this underground boring, system.
Have you found any sort of supporting evidence in terms of, you brought up before, we didn't go into, but you know, these facilities are meant to be self-sustaining. Have you found anything that may add to or lead to some of that evidence?
Actually, some of the YouTubes you can find on the, you know, you will see things where truckers are taking food supplies into underground tunnels, mostly in the middle part of the country. I haven't seen that here. That doesn't mean it doesn't happen. One of the facilities, which is under the Great Smoky Mountains National Park, you can access the road closest to where that entrance probably is from the Blue Ridge Parkway. And during the wintertime, they can close that down. They close it down. And so anybody, if there's not snow on the ground, can get in there and have, you know, months to be doing stuff. They closed off one road that's the closest to where we think the entrance is, and they closed it for 2 years. And I've been up there. I've seen it where it's been closed off. And they said they closed it off because of water problems. Well, there were no signs of a water problem. And, you know, people just don't believe that that's what happened. In fact, there used to be a water reserve or reservoir near that location, and it was totally dried up, and supposedly they had a water problem. And where the reservoir used to be, they put in they found a 50,000 gallon water tank, mostly buried into the ground where the reservoir had been, and there's pipes coming out of that tank and going into the ground, which indicates they were trying to you know, supply water to something down below. Other confirmation came from two men who worked for the fish hatchery in on the Cherokee Reservation, and the water stopped flowing into where the fish hatchery was located. So two of the men went up the river thinking they might find a beaver dam or something that had blocked off the water, and they couldn't find anything. They were stopped by, I believe, I hope I have my story right, I think they were the ones that were stopped by park rangers with machine guns. And they also lost their jobs when they talked about this.
That's very interesting, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Is it a coincidence?
You start putting the pieces together, you go, oh my goodness. And one little piece may not seem significant, but you put it together with all these other pieces and you go, oh my goodness, there's definitely evidence here.
What's the population and how condensed is it in that, like, spread it out over this area? Is it a big populated area?
Not really, no.
So...
how big a county might be in our country? You know?
Yeah, we actually just got back from America, so it was beautiful country. We loved it. We went up towards Washington State, and we went down to Colorado as well.
Oh, that's pretty country.
Yeah,
Washington
beautiful.
State especially.
Yeah.
Yeah, Colorado can get kind of dry, but it has some beautiful spots too.
Definitely. Yeah, so yeah. Not too big of an area population-wise.
Like our county would probably be around 40,000 people for the whole county.
Yeah.
So it's
that's a big town over here.
Is it?
Yeah. So, yeah.
But that would be a whole county.
Yeah. All right.
Like the town would only be, let's see, the town I live in, I think, is like maybe 7,000 people.
Mm-hmm. So was there rumors sort of going back, like talking to the locals and knowing them, you know, was there sort of iffy stuff that they suspected going back years, or is it only been in later years they've gone, you know, something weird's going on here?
I moved here to North Carolina in 1998. It wasn't too long after that I began to hear these reports of people in the woods running into the soldiers. So that goes back quite a distance. The most recent stories that I've put in the book are the ones about Mount Mitchell and the ones about the underground facility underneath Smoky Mountain National Park. And again, that was another military person who came forward. And it was his curiosity that got him. He was on an intersection south of Cherokee, and he saw this tractor-trailer truck with a very unusual load on the back. And he said it looked like a decontamination chamber that he had seen in the military. And he went up and talked to the driver, who happened to be a woman, and she said she was waiting there for, I think, five other trucks and some escorts to take them to a certain place in the mountains. And so he just stayed around, and his wife was with him, And the other trucks arrived. They all had U.S. Air Force Navy letters on them. The escorts were SUVs driven by people in black SWAT outfits with armed guards. So they followed them, this caravan, at a distance. And when they got to a certain point, they went through a gate in the national park, and then the gate was closed, and they disappeared into the park. He also got pictures, which again I have in the book, of big transport planes, the kind that are cargo planes. And he got a picture of one coming up out of that area, and the back entrance, or the back, what do you call it, like trap door where they unload the stuff, was still open as it was coming from that place. He also got pictures of Osprey helicopters, the kind that are that can drop big loads of whatever. And he said he felt that most of the supplies for that place were being airdropped.
So this is interesting, because talking to who you have, everything is going to be compartmentalized in these types of facilities. So there seems to be a little bit of, you know, obviously there's surveillance going on and defense things going on. We've got the rumor about the animals going in there. Has there, like, when you look at this as a whole, has there been any reports of any weird activity? Like, we talked about the UFOs in the area, but is there anything else that just stands out and you go, you know, that's weird, like reports of just weird lights or lasers or anything like that nature? Or even explosions besides the hums and that?
They've had things underneath the ground that aren't registered as earthquakes, but they feel like earthquakes right in the areas of some of these places. I guess that might be a bit of what you're talking about. We have no official military base right in this immediate area, and yet very close to the Perry Center, people see the camouflage military trucks and stuff on a regular basis. So why is that? And this Perry Center, sometimes it's open to the public, and they allow researchers or students to go in there and use the astronomical equipment. But then other times you can't get in there at all. And one Air Force, a retired Air Force man, he and some buddies were really surveilling this place. And one time they saw a man in a SWAT outfit guarding the front gate of this place. So sometimes it's quite materialist. I mean, like the military, and sometimes they open their doors and they're friendly.
And, you know, you'd be trying to pay
it's
it
a camouflage.
Way.
It's a camouflage operation.
Yeah.
You know.
It'd be like show enough just to let people know, don't come this way, but no, nothing's going on at the same time.
Right. And one of the people who went into this facility, knowing what was probably going on there, said that, you know, it's outdated equipment. It's it looks like people might be working at these offices, but it's so outdated they began to think it was mostly for show. You just have to wonder.
You know,
so if you need mysteries, come to North Carolina.
Yeah, no, and this is fascinating. With the wrap-up of the book and looking into underground bases, what's some of the conclusions you've come to about these bases yourself, like just things that add up? You know, of course there's going to be some theories added in here and left in the wind, but those, you know, things come from, you know, logical thought. It's not like you're just pulling this out of the atmosphere. You've investigated this, you've talked to a lot of whistleblowers, but what's sort of your conclusion that you wrap up the book with these bases? Like, what's some stuff that you can sort of say, you know, I reckon this is going on definitely?
You mean where I've, like, seen it with my own eyes?
Well,
I did an interview with a woman who lives at the almost at the very, very top of something called Sugarloaf Mountain, and it's near the Chimney Rock State Park. And I went with another person from this website up there to interview her at her home. And she told us about, she told us a number of stories. I can mention a couple to you. But while I was interviewing her, and again, she's right at the end of the road at the top of the mountain, and it's a dirt, it's a gravel road, it's narrow, it lots of hairpin turns getting up there. I mean, it's not a major road in any way whatsoever. And this white, unmarked SUV came by, slowed down right, I could see through the window, slowed down right where her house was, went to the end of the road, turned around, and again slowed down right in front of her place. we kind of chuckled, but it made us feel like they knew what we were up to. She had some fascinating stories. She said one night the top of the mountain lit up with floodlights, stayed lit up with floodlights all night long, and that big equipment was dropped by, I assume they were helicopters or something. And the next morning, she and her husband were real curious, and they hiked the rest of the way up at the mountain, which is about a 30-minute hike, I guess. And she said the whole top of the mountain had changed its shape, and there was like fresh sod that was down. So whatever they were doing, you know, changed the top of the mountain the way it looked.
That's a lot of work.
And she also, oh yeah, and fast work too with big equipment. And she also has seen the UFOs in that area too, different kinds. So there may very well be a UFO connection with some of this. I'm not at all sure that it's for the good of most of us.
Has there been any sort of holographic type technology seen in the area?
Yeah, but then we get into a whole different thing. In Cashers, there is this woman who began to give us some of the early photos of UFOs over Cashers. Cashers is at the top of a mountain. It's one of those high-end communities where people live there part of the year. When it gets too hot in the lowlands, they come up and vacation in the mountains. And she has seen so many UFOs that she kind of becomes blasé about it. And one day she was stretched out on her couch looking through her bay window, and she looked up and saw a UFO way up in the sky. Didn't pay any attention until suddenly this beam of light came down from that UFO and hit the parking area in front of her home. And then she heard this big bang on the side of the house, and she said it made her freeze for a second. And when she finally turned, there was a huge hologram that she estimated to be 35 feet tall, because she knows the height of her house. And there in the trees was an apparition or a hologram of Jesus that lasted for about 20 minutes. And it seemed to be somewhat animated, because she described his hair as looking like it had been freshly washed, and it just kind of gently blew in the breeze. The story really captured my interest for several reasons. One, she was raised Jewish, so she has no reason to concoct a Jesus apparition in her yard. And then the apparition also included the fact that he wore a leather tong, like necklace with a leather pouch. And in any depiction of Jesus I've ever seen, I've never seen him with something like that around his neck. Now, apparently they weren't great with pockets back then. They needed money, so maybe that's the way they carried it. But that always stuck out in my mind after she told us that particular story.
That's interesting.
Yeah,
very
I thought
interesting.
So. Yeah.
Now, you've written a book about Jesus yourself, haven't you?
I have.
Would you like going into this story for the viewers and listeners?
Sure. The short title is called Tangible Evidence of Jesus. The long title is Tangible Evidence of Jesus Left Behind for Us to Find. And what I've done is I've found information about Jesus that simply goes way beyond anything that's in the Bible. And there's a lot of it. There's a lot of scientific and archaeological research that's been done, and it's usually buried in these thick, huge books that the average person doesn't want to take the time to read. And buried in all these words, there's some really interesting information. So I go through and I try to read this stuff and pluck out the really good stuff and put it in a very condensed, easy form to read. And my style with all three of my recent books is very much like a magazine. Lots of photos, condensed, easy to read writing. They easily could have been very thick books, but I try to make them, you know, easy to read and quick to read. And so it's fascinating information. I don't know where you want me to go with it. I certainly can go off and tell you some tales.
Yeah, well, you know, not everything, obviously, because we want people to look at the book, but is there a few things that you know, that you could go into that sort of just blew your socks off and just go, I didn't, you know, just unexpected things, I guess?
Yes, there's a man who's in charge of theology, I think, at the University of North Carolina. And he teamed up with a well-known filmmaker, and they did a lot of archaeological research in outside of Jerusalem. And at the time of Jesus, they had very peculiar burial patterns. What they would do is when somebody died, they would put them in one of these family burial tombs in the side of a mountain. And they'd leave them in there for a year until all the soft tissue had disappeared. Then they would go back in there and put the bones in a stone box, which is known as an ossuary.
Yep.
And the way these tombs are designed is you walk in the front door of the hill, and there's a square room, and then off the other three sides, there are niches. So after the bones have been put in these stone boxes, they put them in these niches. Well, the tradition is that when you walk in the front door of one of these, the first niche to the right is always for the leader of the family. And so this one tomb that they found, in the first niche, there were three ossuaries, and they all had inscriptions on them. And one said, Jesus, son of Joseph. One said, and I'm doing this in English because obviously it's not in English. One said, it was a familiar or like a nickname, familiar name of Mary on another ossuary. And that name also had Mara attached to it. Mara is the feminine form of Lord. So it was like the female form of Lord with this name, Mary. And it's very, very unusual for nicknames to be used on ossuaries at that time. I mean, it just wasn't done. They used your full name. So to have something other than your formal name on your ossuary is unusual. There was a third ossuary in that same niche and said, Judah, son of Jesus. They have done some DNA research on this, and there is no bloodline connection between the Mary and the Jesus in that tomb. So it wasn't a mother and a son or a sister and a brother. There was no family link to them.
So they could have been Magdalene. More.
Oh, yeah. That's my belief on it and many, many people's belief on it. To support the idea that it was the family burial tomb of Jesus, in some of the other niches, there were other interesting names that were associated with Jesus in the New Testament. And another one had a nickname on it, and it was Josie, which was the nickname that Jesus gave to his brother, Joseph. He always called him Josie. So there was a second, nickname on an ossuary. So that's part of that story. There's more to it, but that at least gives you an idea.
So it connects, you know, it does connect up, and, you know, you connect these pieces and you do enough investigation, you can see where people are coming from when they're saying these types of things and doing the work like you're doing. I read somewhere that didn't President Jimmy Carter write to you about this book?
A number of years ago, I had the occasion to meet him in person. Another long story, which has nothing to do with anything I've written. But when the book came out about Jesus, I sent him a copy, and I had my letter on it. And what he did was he sent back my letter with a handwritten note on the top. I can't even quote it now, but it was something like very helpful, useful information. And he is known as the most famous Sunday school teacher in the world, probably. And people still go there when he's in town, and he conducts a Sunday school class before the actual church service.
Well, so that's a good thing for you.
I thought that was kind of neat that he took the time to do that.
Definitely, definitely. Now, Mark Eddie, I think it is, who's been helping me get some of these guests on, like yourself, a fantastic guest. He was talking about something that you may have a clump of hair or something that you're getting analyzed at the moment.
Oh, that's still in the works.
Can you say anything on that?
Yes, sure I can. And if people want to read this story, because the story is much better than what I'm going to be able to tell you, on the homepage of the Skyships Over Cashers website, on the right-hand side, we have the list of the most recent 25 stories. And one of those is called Valley of the Bigfoot and the Little Alien Dude. So if you want to read a good tale about Bigfoot, just open that story up. We got a large clump of hair, which we believe is Bigfoot hair, and I have a photograph on it, of it, on that, in that story. And because it looks so real, we were contacted by a man in California who was willing to put up the money to have it DNA tested because he thought it looked convincingly real. And so that's been sent off, and I don't know, sometime this summer we may get some results on that one.
So obviously it takes a bit of work to do something like this scientifically and to analyze it.
Apparently, or we get in line and have to wait our turn. That may be more the reality of it. But the story is very interesting because the people live in, in a little valley totally surrounded by mountains. And to get there, you go down this little narrow road that's wedged between two ridges. It follows a little creek, and then it opens up into a little bowl-shaped valley. And there's two houses there and a horse barn. And the people were trying to repair the dam for the pond, and they were using jackhammers, and they suddenly broke into something hollow. And after that, they began to have all sorts of Bigfoot problems. In hindsight, they think they probably drilled right into one of the caves that they lived in, because there are caves all around that little valley. The woman who let us come onto the property said she, for a long time, has felt like, you know, something in the woods was watching her, but she never had any sightings. She never had any reason to be concerned. But after they apparently busted into Bigfoot's house, they began to first explore their cars. They had handprints all over the cars. They went from there to getting inside the car. They had left the keys in there. They turned on the car. It didn't go anywhere, but the lights came on. The next step was they started breaking into the houses. You could see where they, I have pictures of the handprints around the doors and stuff where you could see where they were trying to get in. And one of the most interesting things is the people have moved out. They moved out of the house 2 years ago, but they still go back there almost daily. And the Bigfoot seemed to have taken over the inside of at least both of these houses. But in the room where the children of these people used to live, it appears that the juvenile Bigfoot have perhaps decided that was their play area. And you can see where they have taken like Sharpie pens, and first they would just do scribbles on the wall, and then you could see them trying to draw pictures or trying to emulate writing. And one of the reasons we think it's juveniles is because a lot of this is done below the light switch, you know, and a big burly UFO, I mean not UFO, but Bigfoot, most likely wouldn't crouch down to do that. And we have pictures of that on the on that website, or, you know, in that story. So if you want to take a look at it, we've got it there for you.
It's all there for people to look at. Has there been any other sort of Bigfoot cases you come across that has taken your interest?
Yeah, but let me lean over and get a drink of water. Hold on.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not normally the big talker, but I've been on a roll here.
Doing good.
For the website, I think I've done maybe five other stories of people who have seen Bigfoot. The second most interesting story is of a man who had to retire early from the military because of health problems, and he chose to live on the edge of one of the national forests where a big mountain goes up behind his place, and about 30 feet below his place there is a creek. And he first began to hear sounds, and they're typical Bigfoot sounds, where you take a big branch and you bang it against a tree. Those were the first sounds that he heard. And then one day, he was on his front porch, again, overlooking this stream, and he heard, it sounded like children playing in the creek, but he knew there were no kids around. He's really in a very remote area. And it ended up being two juveniles. To cut to the chase, he eventually found out it was a pair of Bigfoot with two young ones. And he eventually made friends with them, with the male. The other ones wouldn't come near him. But when he does gardening, the male will come down and watch him garden, and he shares some of the food from his garden with him. It was also very interesting. He said the first time he saw them cross the road at night was, he said the female always crossed the road first, then the two young ones, and then the male. And he said they always crossed in that order. So a little bit of insight into how Bigfoots conduct their private life.
A little bit of hierarchy going on there.
Yeah.
So
yes, very much so.
What we can go into now is, and this is fascinating, would you mind going into the book you did called Cherokee Little People Were Real?
Okay. It's a book I never intended to write. I didn't even pay much attention to the legends I heard when I first moved to the mountains. Kind of dismissed them as old Cherokee legends and not, you know, anything to mess with. Well, at the place I was working at the time, there was a elderly man who came in to the place on a regular basis. And one day, I don't know how we got on the subject, but we got on the subject of little people. And he said, no, they're real. And after World War II, he had been involved with a construction crew at a nearby university. It's known as Western Carolina University. And he said when they were cutting into land that was supposedly virgin land, they would find these little square-cut tunnels. Typically, they'd be like 2 feet across, 3.5 feet high, square-cut on the side, square-cut on the bottom with a rounded top. And the rounded top gives it stability, gives a tunnel stability. And he was not the only one. I ended up interviewing a total of 11 people. Nine of them had done construction projects of one sort or another at this university. So when they were putting in sewer lines or building a new building, they would find these little tunnels. And so there was like a network of them all over that area. Then they began to find little skeletons. And one of the first stories that really caught my attention was that they told me about this one science professor at the university who would keep a small skull on his desk, like a decorative paperweight, and he said it was a child skull, you know, an Indian child skull. And one day another teacher came by and picked it up and looked at it real closely and said, this isn't a child skull, it has all of its wisdom teeth. You know, but there's a bunch of stories. We have Bigfoot and we have Littlefoot, and they're just...
It's all so interconnected, isn't it?
It is. And to make it even more confusing, there are three distinct descriptions of the little people. The Cherokee people originally originated from the Great Lakes region in the middle of the United States, and they moved to the mountains. When they arrived here, they discovered these little well-tended gardens, but they never saw any people. Eventually, they saw these little people come out of these tunnels at night, work the gardens during the night, and then take the produce back into the tunnels. And so in the beginning, the Cherokee called these little people the moon people because they worked at night. They were described as having skin with a blue tint to it and large eyes. So that was one description. A second description was that they had red whiskers and looked a little bit like leprechauns. In fact, in the book I have an ancient medallion that was found of one of these faces. There's a profile on each side of it. And right next to it I have a profile of a leprechaun, or, you know, artwork of a leprechaun. And they look very, very similar. And this medallion was found after a major flood in this area back in 1940, where just tons of topsoil was washed away. So this was a very ancient medallion and supports the idea that some of the little people looked like leprechauns. The Cherokee, not now, but in the past, didn't like the ones with the red whiskers, and they would try to kill them. Support from that came from moonshiners. And up at the top of one of these mountains back in during Prohibition, when we couldn't sell alcohol in this country, there was a lot of moonshining going on, and the moonshiners would try to hide their places back in the mountains. So they were preparing their new moonshine place, and they came across this pile of little bones, which might make you think that perhaps some of the red-whiskered ones really did get killed. Nobody heard about that until a long time after the Prohibition, because they didn't want their moon still to be discovered. And the third description, which is the most common one, is that the little people look very much like the Cherokee today, only they're in a more, you know, much smaller. The title of the book is Cherokee Little People Were Real, but there is a lot of support for the idea that there's some that still exist in the more remote areas of the mountains, especially in the remote parts of the reservation.
So there's still some stories going around and sightings?
Mm-hmm. And there's an ancient rock here. It's called the Judicula Rock. And I went out and measured it one day. It's roughly 20 feet by 15 feet. And it has all these carvings all over it. And nobody has been able to decipher them or make any kind of sense out of them, including the Cherokee. And the rock apparently existed before the Cherokee were here. So some people guess that maybe the little people are the ones that carved it.
In this area, is there any reports of paranormal or high strangeness type of activity?
Not as much as you might think. Mm-hmm. On our website, I only have, as far as I can remember, one story about ghost. Mm-hmm. I haven't heard of any abduction stories, mm-hmm. though some of those things may happen, but lots and lots of sightings.
Yeah. No, definitely.
And we did have one report of one landing. It would be one of those small scout ships. So who knows?
What about yourself? What's got your interest into this? Have you had experiences yourself?
I've seen a few UFOs at a distance here in the mountains, but I live on the side of a mountain and I'm under trees. So in order to see the night sky, I have to leave the premises and go, you know, to an open area to even get a good view. So I'm not really in a great place to be a regular observer of what's flying around up here. I actually saw more UFOs when I lived in Florida on the beach. There you have, you know, wide open sky. And I was between Patrick Air Force Base and the Cape Canaveral Space Center. And so I would see the launches. Oftentimes there were also things that looked like UFOs at the same time. But I saw much more down there.
So obviously what you investigate, it sort of just comes and drops on your plate. It's not like you're looking for it. It's just certain things will come across and you'll be like, just led down that path to go and investigate.
Any book I've written, I never intended to write it. I wrote the Cherokee Little People book because nobody had recorded that information. And the people I interviewed were mostly in their 80s when I interviewed them. I knew they weren't going to live much longer, and just about all of them have died since then. And it needed to be recorded because nobody had done it. The same thing with these underground facilities. They've not been written about. Most of us in this country have heard about the ones out west, have heard about Area 51 and Dulson and many more, but they don't know about the ones here in the eastern mountains. And so when I found out nobody had done that, I thought, okay, I need to get this out there. So I'm more into preserving information than I am about trying to write books. I start from that point of view, not like somebody, ooh, I got to write a book. That's not how I operate.
So since bringing out these books, have you attracted other people interested in the subjects that you like? For example, with the underground bases, have you attracted, since bringing out that book, other people that can add to or, you know, give you more stuff on those bases? Like, it's sort of like you bring out the book. Have you attracted more information on that?
Yes, and I will. And the place where that news will break will be on the website. I've got several things. I just haven't taken the time to write them up, but I will. So, yes, the information continues to come in. Even with the Cherokee Little People Were Real book, I've been contacted since that book came out One story of interest was a guy who had been a student at the university, I think in 1999 or 2000, and he and some buddies were just off campus on the river, just relaxing and having a good time. Excuse me. And the head of security came along, and he was carrying a box that was a little bit bigger than a shoebox, and he started a conversation with the guys, and he revealed to them that, you know, they kept finding these little bones when they would be digging and building new buildings, and they would take them, and he was going to rebury them on an ATV trail so that they wouldn't have to stop construction. You may have found it to be true that institutions, they want to build their buildings more than they want to preserve ancient information.
And I think that's, you know, what's going on in a lot of places. And, yeah, look, we even look at Egypt and that, you know, they want to preserve it, but, you know, not in certain ways. So this is where a lot of places just want to build new stuff and they don't want to preserve history. And I think a lot of the time they want to get rid of history. What's your idea on that? Do you think a lot of people just want to wipe out certain parts of history, I guess, to fit, you know, what the history books say?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that's happened here at the local university because to this day they supposedly have some of these little skeletons and even, I'm told, two giant skeletons buried in their forensic lab. But they don't want to talk about it. Because it disrupts the status quo when it comes to the traditional view of history. The Smithsonian has been notorious about this, and I did a story on a book that came out just a couple years ago about how the Smithsonian had all these giant skeletons that were turned over to the institution, and they just bury them back someplace and denied the history that would be involved with giants having lived in our country. And they just don't want to upset the status quo for whatever reason.
Yeah, it's they would have to write a hell of a lot of different history books. And I think even again, that would be wiped out and I'd have to redo it again with how we continue to evolve.
Right.
Has it been interesting for you getting into all this? Like, it's mystery, isn't it? Going into this.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that may go back to, well, first of all, I was born with a curiosity, so I can't blame it on the newspaper business. But the newspaper business does make you want to track down things and get to the truth of matters. So that's certainly a part of all this.
Well, we need more journalists like you again, because it's been like a bit of a weird patch for the last few years, I think, and a lot of repeating stories without, you know, any investigation on a lot of parts of journalists. But there are good journalists out there, and, you know, they're few but far. So this is where it's great doing the work that you're doing. Now, we're about to wrap it up in a couple. We've got a couple of minutes to go. Do you want to just go over anything that you're working on at the moment, or websites, those types of things again?
I haven't mentioned that all the books are available on Amazon, so anybody in the world can get them. And I'll just run through the titles. One is Cherokee Little People Were Real. One is Tangible Evidence of Jesus Left Behind for Us to Find. The most recent one that just came out at the very end of June is Underground Military Bases Hidden in North Carolina Mountains. There are some people who like to support independent bookstores, so if they don't want to use Amazon, they can order through the local bookstore where I live. It's called CityLightsNC.com. The NC stands for North Carolina, CityLightsNC.com, and so you can get the books any of those ways.
That's fantastic. And again, there'll be a link to the website. Is it Skyships?
It's SkyshipsOverCashers.com.
Fantastic, fantastic.
And there's a lot of topics on there that I haven't touched on. We deal with cosmic miracles. We deal with. We always have different kinds of articles on there that can just be about anything you can imagine. Just scroll through it.
Well, Mary, we'll wrap it up there. Again, thank you for taking the time to come on the show, and it would be great to just keep in contact and touch base and get you back on sometime, because I'm sure there's so much more we could talk about. But this has been a good introduction for some of the viewers and listeners that may not know of you, and I find your work fascinating. So, you know, again, thank you so much for taking the time.
Well, thank you for inviting me on, and I really appreciate it. You're very pleasant to talk to.
Thank you. Thank you.
And alrighty.
Likewise. Well, thank you, all and right. We'll wrap it up there.
You take care.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.